We know some people are really good at what they do. And it's kind of impressive to watch someone who's a real craftsman or very skilled to accomplish what they've learned and what they're able to contribute. But other people, really, maybe they're not so skilled at what they do. And they might be thinking about a career change. For example, there was a man just this week. We saw this story on the news locally. A man in the Pittsburgh area who robbed a taxi cab. And probably thinking back on the whole situation, he would agree that it was, this is the kind of thing you should not try when there's snow on the ground. You got it. The police simply followed his footprints in the snow, which led directly to his home, and burst in on him, and there he was, sitting in the living room with his loot scattered all around him. You know, criminals are not usually the brightest bulbs, and perhaps even he would be able to learn from this experience, and should he decide to try something again, he might choose a day with different kind of weather. But you know, there really must be an easier way or a better way to gain experience and to gain wisdom that you can apply to the circumstances in your life. Turn with me to Proverbs, the third chapter. Proverbs, chapter 3. And we'll begin reading here in verse 13. Proverbs 3, verse 13. I'm going to read from the New Revised Standard Version. I like the way that it puts some of these phrases. Proverbs 3, 13. Happy are those who find wisdom and those who get understanding. For her income is better than silver and her revenue better than gold. She's more precious than jewels, and nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her right hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness. All her paths are peace. She's a tree of life to those who lay hold of her. Those who hold her fast are called happy. The Eternal by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the deeps broke open and the clouds dropped down the dew. My child, do not let these escape from your sight. Keep sound wisdom and prudence, and they will be life for your soul and adornment for your neck. Then you will walk on your way securely, and your foot will not stumble. If you sit down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. The last couple of sermons are... Among the last couple of sermons have been some on the subject of spiritual wisdom. There are other kinds of knowledge, other kinds of wisdom, which also are useful and practical and important. You can learn how to drive in the snow, how to invest your money, which tie to wear with that suit, or how to make your getaway in a snowdrift. There are various kinds of knowledge and experience and wisdom that we gain as we go through our life and have different experiences, have different opportunities, different things that occurred that we have to learn. But we're talking about spiritual wisdom, which is a special and important kind of wisdom, a wisdom that has to do not with just physical matters, but has to do with our relationship with God and our success in life is in the life he's called us into. Happy are those who find this kind of wisdom. The excerpt or the proverbs that we read here describe all the value that wisdom has, how it's more valuable to us than physical wealth and physical riches. It's the tree of life. It's the way of peace. It's the way that makes life pleasant. Happy are those who find that wisdom. It's too bad we can't just go down to Walmart and check out the character section and pick up a box of wisdom. It'd be nice if we could find it that way. Spiritual wisdom is a skill that we can grow in through experience. In that way, it parallels some of the other kinds of skills that we might gain that are more physical in nature. But we're going to talk about, or continue talking about, this spiritual skill of wisdom. We've talked about how we can grow in it. We've talked about keys to understanding what wisdom is. Today we take another step. The title of this sermon is Applying Wisdom. When we find it and we put it to work in our lives, when we apply it, there are all kinds of positive results. So once we have wisdom, if we are growing in it, how do we put wisdom to work? In other words, how does a person with wisdom behave? And what is the result of wisdom in a person's life when they put it into action? Well, let's begin by turning to Matthew, the 7th chapter. And we'll see here a metaphor or a story that represents something in life, a lesson for us to learn. One that I think we're familiar with, Matthew, the 7th chapter, beginning in verse 24. Matthew chapter 7, verse 24. At the conclusion of what we call the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says this: "Whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock." So what Jesus is describing here is the action of a person who is using wisdom. This is how a wise person behaves, how a wise person lives. I'll liken him to a wise man who built us. If you hear and do the sayings, the teachings, then you're likened to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on a rock. This is talking about a person who makes that effort to apply the teachings of Jesus Christ in his life. That is wisdom. That is the way a wise person lives. But everyone who hears these things of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. We mentioned in one of the previous messages on this subject that foolishness and wisdom are often contrasted in the book of Proverbs. And obviously, to be foolish is to lack wisdom. But beyond that, another aspect of that, of the meaning of the word fool or foolish, is that it describes someone who actively rejects wisdom. The Proverbs speak frequently of those who scoff at wisdom, those who deny wisdom, those who live by their own views and standards rather than accepting wisdom. A foolish person is one, in this case, who has wisdom available. Both of these individuals here have access to the teachings of Jesus Christ. But one of them is foolish, rejects them, ignores them, and does not apply them. He builds his house, by comparison, on sand, and the rain descended and the floods came and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell. And great was its fall. The house wasn't just damaged in the storm, it was destroyed. Now the house in these two examples represents the life of an individual. The house represents the result of the efforts of these people. It's their life. And the life of one who is wise stands strong when the winds come, the floods come, and beat on that house. The reason it stands is because of the wisdom that has been applied by obeying Jesus Christ. In the sermonette, we heard about the trials that we endure. Have you ever considered that enduring a trial requires wisdom? Or better put, as we compare it to this passage, it requires that we have applied wisdom in our lives so that we are strong enough to deal with those storms of life. Either way, there are going to be storms. Whether we build the house on solid foundation or whether we are more casual about life, either way, there are going to be storms. The question is whether we will have the wisdom to stand during those storms. Let's compare Luke's account of the same metaphor or story back in Luke chapter 6. Luke chapter 6. It's the same lesson, and it's very similar, but worded just slightly differently. This one begins in verse 46 with a question, and as we read it, you can almost hear a kind of a sense of almost exasperation or of just bewilderment on behalf of Jesus Christ. He says, "Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things that I say?" The word Lord means master. Why do you call me your master? Why do you look to me as if I'm the one who you should learn from, but yet you do not do the things that I say? That's a pretty important rhetorical question. And then he goes on with the example that we saw. It's very similar to what we saw in Matthew. "Whoever comes to me and hears my sayings and does them, I'll show you whom he is like. He's like a man building a house who dug deep and laid the foundation on the rock." This account, this story, doesn't use the word wisdom, or it doesn't say that he's a wise man, as Matthew did, but it's the same, obviously he is. But he emphasizes the effort of digging deep, of making the effort to get down to the bedrock, so that this life or this house is going to have a solid foundation. The foundation of our life is our willingness to live by the teachings that we learn from Jesus Christ and from God the Father. It's not an easy thing to do. Obedience is hard work. Now, sometimes it comes naturally, especially as we grow in it, and there are certain areas in life where we're more inclined or it's easier for us to be in harmony with God's law. But oftentimes, obedience just simply gets down to a tough decision. And decisions are what wisdom is all about. How are we going to decide to live? Or how will we decide to live? Are we willing to put forth that effort to be sure that our life is built on a solid foundation? Now here in Luke, he just says that when the flood arose, the stream beat against the house and could not shake it. Back in Matthew, it talked about other aspects of the storm, about the wind and the rain as well. But again, it's the same point, that when life becomes difficult, when we become challenged, when we are challenged by our circumstances, we will be able to stand in those circumstances when we have built our lives on the foundation of obedience. That is an application of wisdom. But, verse 49, "He who heard and did nothing is like a man who built his house on the earth without a foundation, against which the stream beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great." Again, the house represents a person's life. What is our life built upon? The person who doesn't have a foundation, as described here in verse 49, is one who is looking for what is easier for now. It's a lot easier to in this case, build a home or build a life, if you don't have to dig down to the bedrock to find something solid where you can put the foundation. It's much easier just to throw it up haphazardly or quickly from the ground up. But there's no foundation. There's nothing there to hold it in place and to give it strength and stability, integrity, in a time of difficulty. It's easier in life to choose the way of that has least resistance. Most of the time, if obedience is challenging and difficult, it's easier just to go with the flow or to make the decisions based on what others around us do or what others expect of us. It's easier to build a life without the foundation of obedience to the instructions of Jesus Christ. Just like it's easier to build a shed without a foundation than it is to build a home with a foundation. It's a lot less expensive, too. If you're not going to the extra effort and labor and extra material of actually putting a foundation under a home, then it goes up more quickly. It goes up more less expensively. The problem is there's nothing to hold it in place when the winds begin to blow, when life becomes difficult. You know, from the outside, the two homes might look exactly alike. They both might have nice yards and shrubberies around it, some fruit trees in the back. They might look just the same from the curb looking at them, but one of them is not going to stand. So the question that we have to ask ourselves is, what is our foundation? A foundation is established by wisdom, by the wisdom of obedience to the instruction of Jesus Christ. You know, it's not as if, in some cases, our lives have no foundation at all. But the question is, how secure and how complete is our foundation? In other words, there are certain parts of our life where we may be well-founded, but other parts where maybe we're not. If the foundation of a building has a crack, then the floodwaters will find it. When the storm comes, if there's a weakness in the foundation, then the flood, the wind, the rain will find it. So again, it's important for us to dig deep and put down a strong and secure, complete foundation. And that, Jesus Christ described in Matthew 7, is what a wise person will do. So the first principle we find is that we apply wisdom in our lives by being obedient. Obedience is often a very private and personal decision. Most obedience takes place between our ears, in our thoughts, in our attitudes, and the choices that we make. Now, often those thoughts lead to actions, but those actions start with a thought. They start with the kinds of things that we value and that we choose to do. And those are personal, individual decisions. Wisdom, it turns out, is a quiet, underlying strength that holds our life in place. And it's established by a whole series of independent decisions and choices to apply the teaching that Jesus Christ has given to us. We establish that foundation by digging deep, by working hard, and by using the wisdom that God has made available to us. James affirms that application of wisdom in his epistle. We'll turn back to James, the third chapter. James, just as a note, was the brother of Jesus Christ, half-brother of Jesus Christ. And he has some things to say about wisdom as well. We'll begin in chapter 3, verse 13. What James says here is a different approach to describing wisdom, but it certainly is the same kind of wisdom that Christ spoke of that we just saw in the Sermon on the Mount. James 3:13, James asks, "Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom." Wisdom is life in action. Wisdom is the application of the understanding and the instruction that Jesus Christ has given to us. And it produces good results, good conduct, as James puts it here. What's visible that expresses our wisdom is the way that we live. James speaks or writes of the meekness of wisdom. Meekness is a form of humility, but it is a strength. It is a strength of commitment, which, while it's not flashy and something that is impressive, it is strength. It is solid in its foundation. It is a strength in the humility that we have. So we live in a way that is humble and meek and yielding to God, but we yield to God by obeying the instructions He's given to us. That's wisdom in action. As much as we talk about wisdom, we keep coming back to a pretty obvious or constant theme, that wisdom is expressed by both obedience and humility. In the next few verses, James describes counterfeit wisdom. Remember, we talked when we read back in 1 Corinthians 3 what Paul called a human or wisdom of men, and I commented that you probably should put that phrase in quotes, because wisdom really is what we've been talking about. It's the ability that God gives us to make sound and wise decisions or good decisions, and the false or the counterfeit wisdom is not wisdom at all. It's human reasoning. So that's described here in verses 14 through 16. Where James writes, "If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, do not boast and lie against the truth." In other words, as another translation puts it, do not pride yourself on your ambition, thus in defiance of and false to the truth. In other words, contradicting or putting your reasoning in place instead of the truth that God provides. So to lie and boast against the truth means to replace God's truth with our own reasoning. That kind of wisdom, it says in verse 15, does not descend from above, but is earthly, sensual, demonic. For where envy and self-seeking exist, confusion and every evil thing are there. This counterfeit of wisdom produces bad results. It produces jealousy, envy, contention. It's characterized by selfish ambition. All of these qualities, jealousy, envy, contention, they're all selfish and self-promoting. The wisdom that's described here, the counterfeit of wisdom, is all about self. It's not from God. It's from our own nature. And worse yet, as it describes here, it's based on the way of Satan. It's the way Satan reasons. And the result of that counterfeit is confusion, instability, and sin, or evil behavior. That kind of counterfeit wisdom is the building of a life or a home without a foundation. James goes back then in verse 17 to describe godly wisdom. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without hypocrisy, or without partiality, and without hypocrisy. Quite a contrast to the way that this worldly wisdom or the wisdom of the reasoning of man is described in the previous verses. Godly wisdom is characterized, as we saw before, by good works of obedience, by sincerity, by one who is considerate, compassionate, humble, and teachable. Those are all qualities that come about and result from applying wisdom in our lives. So when we look for the results of wisdom, we see that it is based, it provides for others rather than just for self. The counterfeit is very selfish. Godly wisdom is for the purpose of serving and of providing for others. So we see in general here that we both apply wisdom and we grow in wisdom by being obedient and by being humble. We apply wisdom in our lives by choosing to obey. Let's contrast that once again with the counterfeit of wisdom back in Proverbs chapter 14. Proverbs 14. One way to understand what something is to see what it isn't. And we'll see that described here in Proverbs 14, verse 6. Proverbs 14, 6. It says here that a scoffer seeks wisdom and does not find it, but knowledge is easy to him who understands. The scoffer that's mentioned here is one who is using that counterfeit form of wisdom that we saw described in James. This is someone whose motivation is based on jealousy or envy or ambition. It's not genuine, it's not unfeigned, it's not wholehearted and straightforward as godly wisdom is described. A scoffer is a person who is arrogant and boastful. The Hebrew word that's translated scoffer literally means to make mouths at. In other words, it means to mimic or to make fun of someone else, to scoff and to scorn what they are or what they are offering to you. It's intended to ridicule someone. Again, compare that to what we saw in the book of James in terms of the counterfeit of wisdom. The scorner is not truly seeking wisdom. It appears, or he puts on an appearance of doing so as a pretense. One who is a scoffer, one who is boastful and arrogant, is dismissive of wisdom and doesn't really need it because he already has all the wisdom. He already has what the wisdom that other people maybe should be seeking from him, at least he feels that he does. So this is a description, then, again, of the person who is we've seen described back in James chapter 3. Wisdom is something that we perhaps may think of as being pretty complicated or that belongs to someone who has special level of intelligence. Well, I suppose that's true when you understand that the intelligent choice is to obey God. And when we do that, then we are going to be able to express and to grow in His wisdom. We'll be able to apply it in our lives. We're warned in Romans chapter 12 to not overestimate ourselves. You'd think that a person who was wise would have something to be proud of or to brag about or to show off. But wisdom is not something that is portrayed or shared in that way. That, again, is the counterfeit. It's the appearance of wisdom that really lacks substance. Genuine wisdom, as we have seen, is characterized by humility. Romans 12:16, when the translators put this chapter together, they tried to put just one thought in each verse in it. It kind of, if we were to format this chapter today, we'd put it in the form of a bullet list. These are characteristics of the kind of the love that we should have and the way that we should express it in our lives. Verse 16 has three different thoughts in it. They're related, but they're a little bit different aspect of this particular idea. It says, be of the same mind toward one another. In other words, to focus on unity and supporting one another. Do not set your mind on high things, but associate with the humble. Don't get above your where you, your station in life. Don't think more of yourself, and to put others to compare yourself unfairly to others. But here's the point I want to emphasize at the end of the verse. It says, do not be wise in your own opinion. Don't claim to be the one who has all the answers. Now, we may indeed have wisdom, and I'm sure that you do. Many of you have been part of God's church and God's way for many years. You have developed wisdom. Your house is standing strong. But part of true wisdom is to not overrate ourselves. Or again, as Paul said in 1 Corinthians 10, where we're looking at a little earlier this afternoon, be careful if you think you stand, because you may fall. In other words, avoid that arrogance that we saw described back in Proverbs 14. Don't be wise in your own opinion. Don't get the idea that your opinion is the sum total of all wisdom. Some people do have that feeling about their opinions. Other translations put it in a similar way, but maybe help us to express the thought. The New Revised Standard says, do not claim to be wiser than you are. I like the New Living Translation. It's a very modern translation that I don't use often, but sometimes it just captures a thought well. It says, don't think you know it all. Or the NIV says, do not be conceited. Again, we keep coming back to some familiar themes when we talk about what wisdom is, how we grow in it, and how we apply it. There are three key factors to wisdom that we can really boil it down to. First of all, as we saw at the beginning, fear God. The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. Secondly, be obedient. And third, be humble. Those are the three key elements that we see of wisdom. What it is, how it works in our lives, how we're established by it. The house or the life that we're building needs to be able to stand through the difficulties and the challenges that do arise. We've all had them. We all experienced them. One more thought along that line. Turn with me back to Daniel chapter 12. Daniel 12. And we'll read verse 10. Actually, verses 9 and 10 in Daniel. In Daniel chapter 12. At the conclusion of this book, there are a number of visions that Daniel had seen that he was not able to understand. And he was very perplexed and concerned and wanted to have understanding of those visions. But we find here in verses 9 and 10 a closing summary statement that is pretty significant. The angel said, go your way, Daniel, for the words are closed up and sealed till the time of the end. Many shall be purified, made white, and refined, but the wicked will do wickedly. In other words, life is going to continue. People will do what they're going to do. None of the wicked will understand, but the wise shall understand. the people who will understand the significance of visions as they are revealed at the time of the end are those who are wise. Now, I've said several times, and I'll continue to say, that we can't know absolutely for sure whether we are living in the time of the end of the age. We certainly see a lot of evidence that that could very well be possible. But whoever that last generation is, when these events are unfolding and when they are revealed, will need to understand what is happening. Who will understand? The wise. Those who fear God, those who obey God, and those who are humble. That's the key that they will allow those who are living at that time to have understanding. So if we might be that generation, then I think it again shows us the importance of the kind of wisdom that we need to have. It comes through that relationship with God. Let's consider for just a little bit what happened to Solomon. Solomon was the man who was given all this wisdom, and we know that in the end it really didn't work out all that well for him. Why? What happened in Solomon's life? Well, I don't think it's hard to identify, especially since basing it on some of the things we've already just been talking about. Turn back to 2 Chronicles chapter 9. Just to establish, once again, Solomon and what God blessed him, the way that God blessed him. 2 Chronicles chapter 9, verse 22. Just a summary verse here about Solomon. It says, so, 2 Chronicles 9, 22, so King Solomon surpassed all the kings of the earth in riches and wisdom. And all the kings of the earth sought the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. Solomon had incredible wisdom. He was unique among all of those at his time. All the other kings and leaders on earth would come to him to seek wisdom and to hear what he would say, perhaps his advice or the things that he had learned and the observations that he had made. They came to listen to him. But what happened to that wisdom? Well, to answer that, we need to go back a little further. Let's go back to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 17. And we always, of course, will be careful not to judge anyone else harshly. Jesus Christ will judge Solomon. And we don't know. We read the book of Ecclesiastes. Toward the end, it seems that maybe he came back to his senses again. Maybe he was restored to some of the wisdom that he had lost. So I'm not being judgmental of or negative about Solomon, but we can learn from some things that happened in his life. Here in Deuteronomy 17, we find a prophecy beginning in verse 14 of the people when they come to their land that God had given to them. He says in verse 14 that there'll come a time when the people will say, I will set a king over me like all the other nations around me. Now we read in 1 Samuel some time ago another sermon about that very situation. The people looked at their nation, they looked at the others around them, and they wanted to have a king. They wanted to be like all the other kids on the block, and they wanted to have a king like all the other nations did. God knew that was going to happen, and so he established some guidelines. We'll just drop down for now to verse 16. Deuteronomy 17, 16. He shall not multiply horses for himself, nor cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. In other words, not to go elsewhere, in particular to Egypt, to find more. Horses represented power and authority and strength, used primarily in their for their army. And so God said, don't multiply strength for yourself in that way. Verse 17, neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. Nor shall he greatly multiply silver and gold for himself. Now, as we read that instruction to the men who would eventually become kings over Israel a couple of hundred years later, anything come to mind in relation to Solomon? What did Solomon do? Solomon took advantage of his position to amass for himself incredible wealth. He had, Second Chronicles 9. 2 Chronicles 9. I'm not going to take the time to read all this. It begins in verse 13. You can do this. This describes the wealth and the power that Solomon amassed and apparently put his trust in. It said not to, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but not to amass great wealth. The king was not to amass great wealth for himself. Verse 13, the weight of gold that came to Solomon each year was 666 talents. Now, I looked it up. I failed to jot it down. This represents, the 666 talents represents thousands of pounds of gold every year. And he made gold shields out of gold and goblets out of gold. All of his drinking vessels were gold because silver was too cheap. He wouldn't use silver for a drinking goblet. Verse 25, Solomon had 4,000 stalls for horses and chariots. You know, also there in Deuteronomy 17, there's an instruction to those who would become king that they were to write out for themselves a copy of the law. Now, that was a tedious and painstaking process. They didn't just dash it off quickly by hand in a casual way. Whenever a copy of the law was made, it was very precise and very careful. And most likely a king would have been supposed to have been tutored or overseen by a priest who would be sure that he was writing it down just exactly the way that it was initially recorded. So this was something that a king was supposed to do. Now, I don't know whether Solomon did that. It doesn't say whether he did or not. If he did, if he had, then maybe he would have been more familiar with what it says in that particular passage. But whether he did or not, he was responsible to do it, and he should have known that instruction. Solomon had this great wisdom, but he didn't apply it to obedience. He didn't carefully dig down deep and build a solid foundation of that kind of character. Now, I'm not sure that God expected it of him. I'm not sure, again, how Jesus Christ is going to judge Solomon. But we see a comparison here, that for all the wisdom that he had, he did not apply it in the way that Jesus Christ is teaching us to apply wisdom. For all of his wisdom, Solomon didn't keep his heart pure toward God. As I've said before, having wisdom is only part. We must apply the wisdom, which means to fear God, to obey God, to remain humble or teachable. We know that Solomon's had, 700 wives and 300 concubines, and the women, it says, turned his heart from God, which is exactly what the warning was in Deuteronomy 17. Don't do that, or else your heart will be turned. And that's exactly what Solomon did. So what happened to Solomon was, he didn't follow through and obey, even though he was given great insight and wisdom and perhaps the ability to communicate and to he had a great deal of charisma. but he didn't have the kind of wisdom that Jesus Christ urges us to establish in our lives. Now let's look at one other aspect here. We've talked about applying wisdom through obedience, through fear of God and being humble before God, and structuring our lives in a way that builds that solid foundation. But what about when you need to make an important decision? What about those times when you need wisdom to make an important decision? Can you count on God to give you wisdom in those circumstances? Let's look at a couple of verses to see some principles. First of all, Colossians chapter 1. Colossians, the first chapter. We'll read in verse 9. In the introduction here to this epistle, Paul is writing about the example that the congregation there at Colossae set for their faithfulness and for their love for one another and their love for him and for the other ministers. And so we pick up his thought here in verse 9 of chapter 1, where Paul says, "For this reason we also, since the day we heard it," that is their example of faithfulness and of love, "we do not cease to pray for you and to ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding." There's something that we can pray for. As Paul prayed for the church, we can pray as well. We've already talked about the concept of praying for wisdom. Here, that prayer, what we're praying for, is expanded upon just a little bit. We can pray that God will fill us with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. See, this is something that we grow in. We've talked about how the Holy Spirit is the source of, is the way that God can give us access to his wisdom. And part of what we look for and part of what we ask God to provide us with is that wisdom and spiritual understanding that comes through the presence and the work of his Spirit in our lives. So when we need to make decisions, we certainly want to make them based on God's wisdom, on his will, and what we understand, how we understand we should apply that in a particular decision that we're making. And so our prayer can be that we would be filled, as Paul says it here, with the knowledge of his will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. We make a lot of decisions, some of them very important ones, others that are more common or ordinary kinds of decisions. But we always want to make them based on God's will, on his wisdom, and on spiritual understanding. So that's part of what we can pray for, so that when we make decisions, we are able to draw on that strength. Now, let me emphasize again, that we have that kind of a connection to and relationship with God based upon our foundation, based upon our relationship with God that we've established by showing that we fear him, that we will obey him, and that we will remain humble before him. And as we come before God with that frame of mind and that heart, that attitude, then we can expect that he will grant us wisdom and spiritual understanding of his will at various junctures or times in our lives when we're making decisions. Some of them, again, very important. Others, maybe a little more ordinary, but we still want to make the right decision. Notice how this thought continues into verse 10. Be filled with the knowledge of his will and all wisdom and spiritual understanding, that you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing him. You see, the reason that God grants us this wisdom and spiritual understanding of his will is so that we can continue to walk in a way, to live in a way that is worthy. In other words, that is appropriate, that represents the calling that God has given to us. It takes us right back to that point that's so obvious that we keep bumping into. Obedience. Walk in the way that God would have us live. That's the main point of the spiritual understanding and the wisdom that God gives to us, so that we can live in a way that will fully please Him and live up to the calling that we've been given. Wisdom is not, as we pointed out, the contrast in James 3, the counterfeit wisdom is very selfish and self-centered. Godly wisdom has to do with our relationship with Him and our, as James points out, our relationship with one another as well. It's not a selfish part of our lives. It's something that we use to continue to worship God, to please Him, and to be and to walk worthy of the calling He's given to us. The decisions we make, we want to be worthy of God, worthy of our calling. Worthy not in the sense of deserving, but in the sense of properly representing what God is about and the calling He's given to us. So, when we make decisions in our lives, we certainly can ask God to grant us the understanding that we need in order to make those decisions effectively and properly. Sometimes we may not know which direction to turn, which way a decision should go. Look at Ezra chapter 8, and we'll see another principle. Ezra chapter 8, verse 21. Again, we're considering now what our approach should be when we need to make a decision that we see as an important one, a decision in our lives that affects our relationship with God. Ezra chapter 8. I'm not going to read the context here. If you flip back to the beginning of the chapter, you'll see that this is when Ezra is returning to Jerusalem, and it lists the names of some of those who were traveling with him, who would be serving in the temple. But I just want to drop down to verse 21 in Ezra 8. Ezra says, "Then I proclaimed a fast at the river Ahava, that we might humble ourselves before our God, to seek from Him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions." This was a dangerous journey that they were making. It was not an easy one. It was a difficult time, and there were a lot of different factors that would play into it here. Ezra and those he's traveling with are seeking the wisdom of God in knowing the right way for them to go, the right decisions for them to make, so that their families and their possessions would be safe, that they would make decisions that God would be pleased with. They fasted to humble themselves so that they could seek His wisdom. Fasting is a very important tool in our lives. Fasting is primarily for the purpose of worshiping God and humbling ourselves before Him. As the people here took that step, they were presenting themselves to God in this way. Now, fasting certainly humbles us very quickly. We don't need to miss very many glasses of water or cups of coffee or meals to feel awfully weak. And we recognize very quickly the lesson that God must strengthen and support us in every way, and that we must live spiritually by every one of His words, just as we live by the bread or the food that God provides for us. Fasting is an essential part of our relationship with God because it teaches us that lesson of humility, which will make it possible for us then to draw into a stronger relationship with Him and to seek His wisdom, His direction, the answers that we are looking for, the decision that we may be faced with. there's no simple formula for making every decision. But there are principles that we see of our relationship with God. Principles that help us to express the wisdom that we have and to grow stronger or into a stronger level of wisdom. Again, those three key points: to fear God, to obey God, to humble ourselves before Him, seeking His direction in our lives. I've often referred to, and I'm not going to read it, but we can look back at 2 Chronicles chapter 20, just to kind of rehearse very briefly the situation here, where Jehoshaphat was the king of Judah, and he was surrounded by the armies of Moab and Ammon, who were very aggressive people who were determined to attack the nation of Judah, and they really had no defense against them. There was no way that they could protect themselves from these invading armies. And so, in verse 3, Jehoshaphat feared, he was afraid of the situation, and he set himself to seek the Eternal and proclaimed a fast throughout all Judah. And we do that from time to time, don't we, as a church? There'll be a situation where it's important, a certain decision needs to be made, or blessing that we're looking for, that asking God to show us that kindness and that help to us as a church. And we'll have occasionally a church-wide fast. We see here a precedent for that. Remember, the purpose of the fast is to humble ourselves before God, to honor Him and worship Him, recognizing that He is the one who provides us with everything that we need in this life. That draws us closer to Him and allows us to seek His wisdom. But notice what it says in verse 12, 2 Chronicles 20, 12. This is Jehoshaphat's prayer as they were fasting. He said, "O our God, will you not judge them?" In other words, those who are surrounded and threatening the people, the nation. "For we have no power against this great multitude that is coming against us, nor do we know what to do, but our eyes are upon you." I've come to that point a few times in my life, and I'm sure you have too. Looking at a circumstance, looking at a situation, and you have to admit, I don't know what to do. I need God to show me the way, to give me the understanding and the wisdom that I need so that I can know what I should do. I don't know what to do. Very humble, very worshipful approach of looking to God for His wisdom and for His intervention. So there are times when we will come before God, perhaps in fasting, to seek His wisdom and to ask Him to show us what we should do, to give us the understanding, to give us the ability to choose and to make the right decision. We know from 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, that God has given us the spirit of love and power and of a sound mind. A sound mind. Now, a sound mind literally means a disciplined mind, a mind that is controlled, a mind that is able to think and able to process and come to decisions that are the right decisions. The discipline we need to apply the principles of God's way to the decisions that we need to make. So we should, obviously, come to God asking Him to give us the blessing of wisdom that will enable us to make right and proper decisions that he'll be pleased with. But here's something that kind of frustrates us, but it's part of the process. Sometimes we want God to make decisions for us that He's not going to make. He will not always take us by the hand or whisper in our ear what we should do. Now, in our own, I guess, insecurity, that's what we really want. We really desire to have a specific answer. But God doesn't always work that way. In fact, much of the time, God gives us, through His Word and through His Spirit, instruction and understanding of principles so that we can make decisions that are within His law. All of our decisions must be within God's law. We should never make one that violates God's law, but oftentimes there will be two or more options that are within God's law. He wants us to learn to exercise that kind of judgment, righteous judgment. That's what it means to be created in the image of God, in part, that we have a mind that is able to process, to come to conclusions, and to make decisions. So we pray that God will grant us that spirit of wisdom and understanding. We use the self-discipline and the strength of God's Holy Spirit that He's given to us so that then we're able to make a decision. Again, God is the only one who can tell us what's right and what's wrong. We would never make a decision outside of God's law. Adam and Eve made that mistake. They decided to reject God's instruction and just make up their own way. That's never what we should do. But within God's law, there are times, and again, many times, when God is looking to us to apply what He's taught us so that we learn to judge or to make decisions in a wise way and in a righteous way. Now, of course, sometimes it's good to look to others for help. Look at Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15. A wise person will also seek appropriate counsel. Counsel that is appropriate depending on the kind of decision that's being made. A person who is wise will not only seek appropriate counsel, but will accept the counsel that is given. Proverbs chapter 12, verse 15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. See, there's the person who maybe is claiming to be wiser than he is, or is arrogant and thinks that he has all the knowledge that he needs to have. That's a foolish way to think. He who heeds counsel is wise. Now, of course, as I said, we need to seek appropriate counsel. You know, if you're thinking about buying a home, don't come to me. Go to a real estate agent. That real estate agent should be able to counsel you as far and help you to find the kind of home that you're looking for. And if you're given advice and counsel, whether it be something that's physical in that sense, you can reject the counsel. Sometimes people do. They think they're right and the counselor is wrong. That's not always a smart thing to do, but oftentimes people make that decision. There have been many times in my life when in one conversation with an individual, I can go from being a trusted pastor to a complete idiot. If the advice or the counsel that I'm offering doesn't seem to match what they want. And so people often tend to make their own decisions even if they go through the exercise of seeking counsel. A wise person will seek appropriate counsel and will respond to it. We all complicate our lives at times with bad decisions. Whether it's something simple, you buy the wrong refrigerator, you buy the wrong car, move in the wrong neighborhood, relatively physical kinds of decisions. But a lot of those kinds of decisions are not necessarily sinful. They're just not the best, not the wisest thing to do. I mean, if you want to paint your house a fluorescent lime green, you probably could do that. It's not violating any law or any spiritual law that I know of, but it's not a very wise thing to do. there are different levels and kinds of decisions. Some of them are spiritual in nature. Some of them are more physical in nature. In any event, God gives us the opportunity to make decisions and choices. He wants us to learn to exercise wisdom and to make good decisions, to make the right kind of choices that will not complicate our lives. A lot of times, bad decisions maybe not aren't sinful, but they sure do complicate things. They sure do make life difficult. And so, as we come to the point in our lives when we make decisions, we always can look to God to ask Him to help us understand the principles and the reasons for making certain choices in our lives. There are times when we should seek counsel to help us to arrive at the right conclusion or to make the right decision. But we should always keep in mind that God wants us to learn to exercise the wisdom that He makes available to us. And that wisdom is established in our lives through our willingness to fear God, to obey God, and to be humble before God. Let's close things out today and back in Proverbs chapter 4. We could take another several sermons and keep talking about the subject of wisdom. But I've spent enough time on it for now, I think. I'll leave further consideration to your personal Bible study. We keep circling back, in, at least in these messages, to the same fundamentals of wisdom. That it is God's gift to us, to those of us who fear Him, obey Him, and are humble before Him. The value of wisdom cannot be estimated. To live in a way that is unwise certainly causes more than just confusion and difficulty. It actually ruins people's lives. To have that foundation of strength that is established through wisdom and through the practice of God's law is so important to us. Let's conclude here in Proverbs chapter 4, verse 3. It says, "When I was my father's son, tender and the only one in the sight of my mother, he also taught me and said to me, 'Let me retain my words, keep my commandments, and live.'" Who is this person who is writing this? Is this Solomon? If so, it's kind of interesting because, you know, is he speaking of David who taught him these principles or lessons about wisdom? And by the same token, is Solomon writing to his son? If you want to see an example of poor judgment and a lack of wisdom, read what happened to Solomon's son, Rehoboam. Rehoboam, of course, was to inherit the kingdom. Now God had already decided to divide the kingdom, but Rehoboam didn't help himself at all. Rehoboam actually rejected wise counsel and accepted foolish counsel and managed to ravage the whole nation of Israel by those poor decisions. So it's interesting. Is this the instruction that Rehoboam at one time heard from his father, Solomon? And for that matter, Solomon doesn't follow his own instruction here because we know later he rejected wisdom. But it's interesting to kind of consider the personalities that could be involved in this instruction. "He also taught me and said to me," verse 4, "let your heart retain my words, keep my commandments, and live. Get wisdom, get understanding. Do not forget, nor turn away from the words of my mouth. Do not forsake her, and she will preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you." Kind of ironic, I think, that in the Hebrew language, the word for wisdom is a feminine gender. And so he refers to wisdom as she, and she will love you. Remember that it was Solomon's love for foreign women that got him in trouble. But here he's referring to wisdom with this female pronoun, because the word itself is again, feminine in gender in the Hebrew language. So don't forsake her. She'll preserve you. Love her, and she will keep you. Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore, get wisdom. And in all you're getting, get understanding. Exalt her, and she will promote you. She will bring you honor when you embrace her. She will place on your head an ornament of grace, a crown of glory she will deliver to you. Wisdom, as we just saw, is the principal thing. Therefore, get and apply wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson.